Welcome back, everyone, for another deep dive. This time, we're going to be taking a look at medieval Scandinavian literature and history.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got all sorts of cool stuff to work with today. We've got academic essays, historical accounts, and even some excerpts from the sagas themselves.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah. It's like having a time machine, but, you know, made out of words instead of, like, gears and stuff.
That's a great way to put it. And, you know, these sources, they aren't just some, like, you know, dusty relics from the past. Mm-hmm. They're really vibrant narratives, and they offer a window into this culture that was just obsessed with heroism and fate and the power of storytelling.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about the sagas. It's like, you know, we're going on an archaeological dig, but instead of digging up, you know, like pottery shards and arrowheads, we're uncovering these like unexpected echoes across centuries, you know, these shared themes that connect seemingly very different stories and historical moments.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And one of the recurring themes that we're going to encounter is this motif of the bear's son.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you see this figure pop up in both Norse and Anglo-Saxon literature.
Okay.
So think Beowulf, for example, or Bovar Bjarki from Hrolls Saga Kraka.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So are we talking about like literal bear ancestry here? Or is there a deeper meaning, like a symbolic meaning behind this whole bear's son idea?
Yeah, it's definitely more symbolic. You know, the bear in Norse culture was revered for its strength and its ferocity. So calling someone a bear's son, you know, wasn't just some quirky nickname. It was a way of highlighting their heroic qualities, their, you know, almost superhuman strength and this wildness, especially in battle.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like saying that someone is a force of nature, but with a very specific bear-shaped image attached to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this connection to bears, it gets even more intriguing. We look at figures like Sigurd Dyer from the Vita Epasio Valdui Comitis.
Okay.
His name literally means Sigurd the Stout, and he's described as having these bear-like qualities.
I can't help but picture him like trying to fit in at a Viking feast with like, you know, bear ears. But I'm guessing there's more to it than just like a physical resemblance.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sigurd's a bear-like nature, it connects him to the berserkers.
Okay.
These legendary Viking warriors who were known for fighting in this trance-like fury, almost like they were channeling the spirit of a bear.
Oh, wow. Okay, now that you mentioned berserkers, I'm starting to see how this bear motif, it kind of ties into this bigger theme of, you know, masculinity and warrior culture in these sagas. It's not just about physical strength. It's about this this raw, untamed energy that makes these heroes both, you know, terrifying and fascinating.
That's a great observation. And this fascination with powerful, larger than life figures, it extends beyond Scandinavia.
Yeah.
If we kind of jump across the North Sea to England.
Yeah.
We encounter Hereward the Wake.
Oh.
An English hero. Who was resisting the Norman conquest.
Okay.
His story is chronicled in The Gesta Herwarti, and it has these really striking parallels with the Icelandic Greta saga.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so we're talking about two different cultures, two different historical periods, but we've got these similar tales of these outlaw heroes.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what are some of the specific similarities that really stand out to you?
Well, both Hereward and Grettir are known for their incredible strength, their cunning, and their willingness to defy authority.
Okay.
They battle bullies, they outsmart their enemies with these clever disguises, and they even come into conflict with kings.
Wow. So it sounds like they're both walking this fine line between hero and outlaw. I'm guessing their defiance doesn't always go unpunished?
You're right. Both characters face exile and hardship. And there's even this really intriguing parallel where both Hereward and Grettir, in moments of desperation, they resort to killing their own horses.
Whoa. That's intense. I get that they were in desperate situations, but to kill your own horse, that must have been a deeply significant act.
It absolutely was.
Yeah.
Horses were incredibly valuable in this era. I mean, more than just, you know, transportation, they were symbols of status, companions in battle, and essential for survival.
Yeah.
So for a hero to kill his own horse, it speaks to the gravity of the situation, the lengths they were willing to go to survive.
It's like a sacrifice almost. It makes me think about how the natural world, the harshness of the environment, it really shaped the choices these characters had to make. It wasn't just about, battling human enemies. It was about surviving the elements too.
Exactly. The landscape is almost like a character itself in these stories, constantly influencing the lives of the characters and shaping the narratives. But, it's not all survival and epic battles. These sagas also offer these glimpses into everyday life, social dynamics, and even the power of language.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of language, there's this one proverb that really caught my eye. Jaftan sigir in rikri ra. The powerful always have a say.
Right.
It's from Fuspara Saga, and it seems to really encapsulate this whole theme of control and decision making that runs through so many of these stories.
It's a very powerful proverb, and it speaks to the importance of social hierarchy in medieval Scandinavian society. Characters are constantly vying for power, trying to control their own fate, and the fate of those around them.
It makes me think about the characters who don't have power. What happens to them when the powerful always get their way? Are they just pawns in this game of fate and ambition?
That's a question that the sagas explore in these really nuanced ways. We see characters who challenge the status quo, who try to carve out their own destiny despite the odds, and we see others who are just crushed by the weight of those in power, victims of circumstance or their own ill-fated choices.
It's like this proverb isn't just a statement of fact. It's a challenge almost. It forces us to consider how these power dynamics, they shape relationships, destinies, and even the way that stories are told.
And it's a theme that resonates even today, isn't it? We still grapple with these questions of power, control, and the voices that get heard or silenced.
Yeah, it's a reminder that while these sagas may be centuries old, they're still incredibly relevant to, our understanding of the world and the human condition. But before we get, too deep into the philosophical implications, I want to hear more about this proverb in action. Can you give me some specific examples of how it plays out in different sagas?
Absolutely. Let's start by taking a closer look at Njál's saga, one of the most famous and complex of all the Icelandic sagas. Njál's saga, it's a masterpiece of storytelling. It's full of these feuds and betrayals and these, really epic battles. But one of the things that really strikes me about it is this idea of characters willingly accepting their death.
Yeah, you're right. There are some pretty intense death scenes in Njál's saga. I remember Gunnar, trapped in his burning house, he chooses to fight to the end rather than surrender.
Right.
And in Njál, he refuses to leave his home, even though he knows it means certain death.
Yeah.
It's both heroic and tragic at the same time.
It is. And it raises all these questions about how people viewed fate and free will back then. Was it a matter of honor, or was there this deeper sense of accepting one's predetermined destiny?
I'm really fascinated by that idea of choosing death rather than, compromising your honor. It seems so foreign to our modern sensibilities,
Right.
but within the context of the saga, it makes a certain kind of sense.
Exactly. These characters, they're driven by this code of honor that often trumps even the instinct for self-preservation. And it's not just about individual glory. Their choices, they have these ripple effects that, shape the destinies of entire families and communities.
It's like each death, each act of defiance or acceptance, it adds another layer to this really intricate tapestry of fate and consequence.
Right.
It makes you realize that these sagas weren't just entertainment. They were, a way of exploring the complexities of human nature
Yeah.
and the forces that shape our lives.
Precisely. And speaking of exploring complex themes, let's shift gears for a moment and talk about skaldic poetry. It might seem like a leap going from, bloody battles to intricate wordplay, but trust me, there's this really fascinating connection here.
Okay, you've got my attention. Skaldic poetry always sounded so incredibly complex to me with all its intricate rules and kennings and all this. But I'm curious, how can it reveal insights into Icelandic identity?
Well, skaldic poetry was more than just, pretty words. It was a way of encoding cultural knowledge, preserving history, and expressing a unique worldview. So imagine, instead of saying sword, the poet says wave biter.
Okay.
That's a kenning. It's a kind of metaphorical whittle
Right.
that adds all these layers of meaning to the poem.
Okay, I can see how those kennings could make things pretty challenging for someone trying to understand the poem,
Right.
especially, if you're not familiar with the cultural context. But I'm guessing the payoff is worth the effort.
Absolutely. By deciphering the kennings and analyzing the language, we can uncover all these subtle clues about how Icelanders saw themselves
Right
and
on.
their place in the world.
So it's like these poets were creating a linguistic fingerprint, a unique way of expressing their Icelandic identity through the very structure of their language.
Exactly. And one of the fascinating things we see is how they incorporated elements from other cultures into their poetry,
Okay.
particularly Irish influences.
Okay, so we're not just talking about this pure, unadulterated Icelandic identity. It's more of a blend,
Yeah.
a fusion of different cultural elements that came together to create something new and unique.
Precisely. And this blending of influences is reflected not only in the language, but also in the stories themselves. Remember Snaeglu Hala Thatcher, that humorous tale about that trickster poet we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, Haley the Trickster. He definitely left an impression.
Exactly.
What's the connection to Icelandic identity there?
Well, one way to think about it is through this concept of skaldic prosaics. It's kind of a mouthful, but essentially it means that some sagas and thought here, these shorter narratives, they use techniques that are very similar to skaldic poetry. It's like when a rapper uses wordplay and rhyme schemes in their everyday speech.
Okay.
It adds this layer of artistry and complexity to their communication.
Okay, I get it. So Sneglu Hálaþáttr, with its witty dialogue and clever wordplay, it's almost like a prose poem
Yeah.
that reflects this Icelandic love of language and storytelling.
Exactly. And it's not just about the language. The
Oh.
story itself, with its focus on this trickster figure, who outsmarts those in power,
Yeah.
it speaks to this certain rebellious spirit that is often associated with Icelandic culture.
I like that. It's like Halley, the trickster poet, he embodies this idea that even within a hierarchical society, there's always room for those who, can think outside the box and challenge the status quo. But you mentioned a connection to Loki earlier. How does the Norse god of mischief fit into all of this?
That's where it gets really interesting. Halley's character, he shares some really striking parallels with Loki.
Oh, okay.
They're both known for, their wit, their cunning, and their ability to kind of bend the rules.
So it's like the Thoughtry is drawing on mythology to create this more complex and layered character. It's almost like Halley is like a human embodiment of Loki's mischievous spirit.
Exactly. And it's not just about, personality traits. There are even specific episodes in the Thoughtry that mirror some of Loki's most famous exploits.
Okay.
For example, both Halley and Loki, they managed to acquire valuable treasures through their cleverness and trickery.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. What kind of treasures are we talking about here? Golden apples, magic rings.
Well, for Halley, the treasures are a bit more down to earth. A gold
Yeah.
piglet, golden rings, won in a head wager, and even a hefty amount of silver from the English king. But the point is that these seemingly mundane gains, they're elevated through the comparison to Loki's mythical treasures.
Yeah.
It's like the Thoughtry is saying, look, our hero, he may not be a god, but he's just as clever and resourceful.
I love that. It's like a subtle wink to the audience,
Right.
acknowledging the shared mythology while still grounding the story in a human context. Speaking of mythology, we can't forget about Egil Skallagrimsson,
Right.
the poet warrior whose saga is full of epic battles, and as you mentioned earlier, a rather intense scene involving beer, vomit, and blood.
Ah, yes. Eagle. He's a fascinating and complex figure, a brilliant poet, a fierce warrior, and let's be honest, a bit of a hothead. That scene you're referring to, it's one of the most memorable in the entire saga. And it's a perfect example of how these skalds could weave together these multiple layers of meaning within a single episode.
Okay, I'm ready for the deep dive. break down the symbolism for me. How does a scene with beer and vomit and blood connect to the mead of poetry?
It all goes back to the myth of Kvasir, this wise being that was created from the saliva of the gods. Kvasir is eventually killed, and his blood is mixed with honey to create the mead of poetry, the source of poetic inspiration. Now, fast forward to Egil's saga. Egil's at a feast, and he gets into this heated argument with a man named Bard. The tension escalates, and Egil ends up killing Bard. At that very moment, as Bard falls, beer, vomit, and blood, they mix on the floor.
Okay, so it's not just a random coincidence. It's a deliberate mirroring of the Kvasir myth, right? Like a symbolic reenactment of the creation of the mead of poetry. But why is that significant? What does it tell us about Egil and his poetry?
To fully understand the significance, we need to look at the kenning that Egil uses in the stanza he recites right before killing Bard. He uses this rather obscure kenning for blood, referencing the reign of the Thanes of the High One.
But I'm still not seeing the connection to Kvasir and the mead.
To decipher the kenning, you have to trace back the origins of the mead of poetry. It forces you to remember the myth, to recall the blending of Kvasir's blood with honey, and suddenly this seemingly random mixing of bodily fluids in that scene, it takes on this whole new meaning. It becomes this metaphor for poetic inspiration itself.
That's pretty mind-blowing. It's like these skalds were playing this game of literary hide and seek, embedding these layers of meaning that only reveal themselves if you know the rules.
It's a testament to the complexity and sophistication of their art. They weren't just, telling stories. They were creating these intricate linguistic puzzles that invited the audience to participate in the act of meaning making.
And it makes you realize that reading these sagas isn't just about passively absorbing information. It's about actively engaging with the text, deciphering the clues, and uncovering the hidden layers of meaning.
It's a challenge, but it's also incredibly rewarding. And it's one of the things that makes studying medieval Scandinavian literature so fascinating. But let's not forget about the other half of our deep dive, the historical context that shaped these stories. We've talked about powerful heroes and their impact on society. But what about the women in these sagas? What can their stories tell us about gender roles and societal expectations?
It seems like women in these sagas, they often get relegated to the sidelines, the wives, the mothers, the daughters, who are just kind of caught in the crossfire of male ambition. But I'm guessing there's more to their stories than meets the eye.
You're absolutely right. While the sagas are undeniably male-dominated, the women are far from passive bystanders. They exert influence, they make strategic decisions, and they even challenge societal norms.
Okay, so where do we start unraveling this? Are there any specific characters or stories that provide insights into the lives of women in medieval Iceland?
One way to approach this is by looking at the Old Norse exempla, a collection of moral tales that were used for preaching and
So
teaching.
not exactly light reading material then. I'm guessing these examples weren't just, bedtime stories. What kind of messages were they trying to convey?
They were definitely intended to shape social behavior, especially when it came to gender roles. Some exa they praise women for their virtue and piety, often holding them up as these models of patience and obedience.
That sounds a bit restrictive,
Yeah.
almost like they're being told to just, sit quietly and endure whatever hardships come their way.
It definitely reflects the patriarchal worldview of the time. But, there are other examples that paint a more complex picture. Some highlight the dangers of female sexuality, portraying women as these temptresses who can lead men astray.
So it's like they're being demonized for their power, their ability to influence men's actions. It reminds me of that classic femme fatale archetype, beautiful but deadly.
And this tension between, idealizing women as virtuous and fearing their potential for disruption, it speaks volumes about, the anxiety surrounding gender roles in this society.
It makes you wonder how women navigated those expectations. Did they conform to these restrictive roles, or did they find ways to, push back and carve out their own space?
That's where the Icelandic ballad tradition offers some really fascinating insights. These ballads, often performed by women, they provide a different lens through which to view gender dynamics.
Okay, so we're moving from sermons to songs.
Yeah.
What kind of stories do these ballads tell, and how do they portray women?
Two ballads that offer contrasting perspectives are Kvæði af Olafi Lýðrós, the Ballad of Olaf Lýðrós, and Elinor Bjoet, the Ballad of Ellen.
Intriguing titles. What can you tell me about these ballads and their heroines?
The Ballad of Olaf Lýðrós, it tells this cautionary tale about a young man who's lured to his death by this supernatural elf maiden. It plays on that fear of female power,
Right.
especially when it's tied to the supernatural.
It's like a warning against succumbing to temptation, especially when it comes in the form of a beautiful, potentially dangerous woman.
Exactly. It reinforces that idea of women as a source of both allure and danger.
Yeah.
But then we have the Ballad of Elin, which presents a very different kind of heroine. Elin is known for her intelligence and resourcefulness. She outsmarts her adversaries, even using disguises to navigate tricky situations.
So she's not just a damsel in distress waiting for a hero to rescue her. She's taking charge of her own destiny,
Right.
using her wits to survive and overcome obstacles.
Precisely. And this contrast, it highlights the fact that even within a patriarchal society, there were different ways of being a woman, different ways of expressing agency and challenging expectations.
It's like these ballads, despite their, traditional nature,
Yeah.
they provided the space for exploring the complexities of femininity and pushing the boundaries of what was considered acceptable behavior for women.
And this brings us to this fascinating concept, gender as performance.
Okay.
It's a way of understanding how the performers of these ballads, often women themselves,
Right.
could use their voices and their bodies to embody these different aspects of femininity,
Yeah.
both reinforcing and challenging societal norms.
So we're not just talking about characters in a story. We're
Well.
talking about real women actively, shaping the narrative through their performance.
Yeah.
It adds a whole other layer of complexity and meaning to these
It
ballads.
does. It reminds us that even within these seemingly, rigid social structures,
Right.
there's always room for individual expression and subversion. And
Yeah.
this interplay between conformity and resistance, it's something that we see reflected not just in the ballads, but throughout medieval Scandinavian literature.
And it makes you realize that these stories aren't just, relics from the past.
Right.
They're vibrant, dynamic narratives that offer these insights into the human condition that are just as relevant today as they were, centuries ago.
Exactly. And one of the things that makes these stories so enduring is their deep connection to the natural world.
Yeah.
The landscape of Iceland, with its rugged terrain, harsh weather, and unique geological features, it's almost like a character itself in these sagas.
It's true. The environment is constantly shaping the lives of the characters and influencing their choices. It's like that saying, we shape our buildings and afterwards our buildings shape us. But in
Yeah.
this case, it's the landscape shaping the people.
Precisely. And this connection to the land, it's deeply embedded in Icelandic identity. Take the Faroe Islands, for example,
Yeah.
as depicted in Fureyinga Saga. The treacherous seas, the towering cliffs, and the lack of resources, it creates this sense of isolation and dependence on the mainland.
It's like the landscape is both a source of strength and this constant challenge.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder how those environmental factors they influence the development of Icelandic culture.
That's a question that scholars continue to explore. The harsh conditions likely fostered a sense of community and self-reliance.
Right.
But they also created this need for trade and interaction with other cultures. It's
Yeah.
like the landscape itself,
Yeah.
shaped the Icelandic character, forging this unique blend of resilience, independence, and openness to the outside world.
And that connection to the land, that sense of awe and respect for the power of nature, it's something that continues to resonate with people today,
right?
Both Icelanders and visitors alike. It's
yeah.
it's a reminder of the deep roots of Icelandic culture and the enduring power of the natural world.
It is, and as we wrap up this deep dive,
yeah,
I think it's worth reflecting on how these narratives, despite their historical and cultural context, offer these timeless insights into the human condition.
Right.
The struggles for power, the complexities of relationships, the interplay of fate and free will.
Yeah.
These are themes that continue to shape our lives today.
They do.
So as you go about your day, see if you can, you know, spot any echoes of these ancient stories in the world around you.
That's a great challenge, to see the threads of these ancient narratives woven into the fabric of our modern lives. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.